Hello, and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle, and with me today is Jesse Lowry. Jesse, tell us who we have on the phone line with us and what this show is going to be about. It's a very interesting topic about bats. Take it away, Jesse.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm Jesse Lowry, Director of Conservation and Research here at Blank Park Zoo, and we are very excited to have Russ Benedict on the phone with us, and he is a professor at Central College and a bat expert. And Ryan, you know that I was a zookeeper for many years. I got to take care of the Egyptian fruit bats, and I just love these little critters. They've got a fantastic story to tell. And so, Russ, we'll get to you in just a moment. I'm going to take just a minute to kind of set the stage of why we have this show, Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. But I always like to say I see it as a window to the wild, a place where we can invite kids and families and schools and just the whole community here to the zoo and look into the eyes of tigers and lions and see the amazing agility of sea lions and see exactly how tall a giraffe is and feel that sense of awe that we all feel when we see these amazing creatures. But as a modern zoo, as a conservation organization, it is our job to turn that sense of awe into a real conservation action, into some kind of behavior change, some kind of action that we can all do in our own lives that's actually going to equate to some impact on the natural world, to make wildlife and the environment better off. And so that's really the mission here at the zoo. And we've got a unique platform to do that. Even though we're a small zoo, we've got an audience of over 500,000 people a year. And so we're really working to create that sense of awe and to drive people to take action. And really, saving animals can take many forms. It can mean being green and recycling and using less resources. It can mean just visiting the zoo because a portion of every dollar that we make goes to save animals in the wild. But I always like to say that if you really care about animals, even if it's giraffe and rhino, what you should do is take care of your local environment. And it's really important to, you know, the old cliche, think global and act local. And that's one of the reasons, Ryan, why we invited the speakers that we have for our speaker series this year. This year it's called Blooms, Butterflies, and Bats. And it's our Hope for the Wild speaker series. We have it every year. It's the first Thursday in February, March, and April. And this is our 12th year, actually. And this is the first year that it's going to be really catered around local environmental issues. And so just really quickly, in February, we've got Dr. Doug Tallamy, and he's an author of Bringing Nature Home. And he'll talk to us about native plants and how adding those to any landscape, including our backyards, is really putting the building blocks of the ecosystem back together. And in March, we have Chip Taylor, who is the founder of Monarch Watch. And he is one of the folks that really helped us figure out the miraculous monarch migration. And in April, we've got Russ Benedict, who we've got on the phone today, talking about bats. And I'll tell you what, Ryan, that's one of the ones that I am really excited about. So, Russ, welcome again to the show. It's really great to have you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm always excited to talk to folks and help folks appreciate bats better.
That sounds great. Well, why don't you go ahead and get started by just kind of introducing yourself and let us know what you're doing at Central.
Okay, so again, my name is Russ Benedict, and I have been a professor here at Central now for, this is my 17th year now. I teach a variety of classes, intro biology, and then mammalogy and ornithology, a tropical ecology class, a conservation biology class. So it's a real mix of all sorts of classes basically aimed at getting kids outside and learning more about the things around them. I got interested in bats very early in my master's degree, and it was kind of fun because I went on a field trip, and I remember distinctly that I didn't want to go. I had something else I was supposed to be doing that night. But within about that next 2 to 3 hours of that field trip, I just knew this was something I was going to do for the rest of my life. There's just something about the charisma of bats, which is something you can't really appreciate until you have one right in front of you in kind of a controlled setting. But they just have these amazing personalities, and then there's just something kind of magical about them. There's so little known about them. They're so hard to study. So there's kind of this whole element of magic just in terms of how we study them.
That sounds wonderful. And, you know, it just reminds me the way that I talk about butterflies. Something about, you know, these charismatic animals that just really, you know, inspires us and makes us want to learn more. And did you grow up being out in nature a lot? What inspired you to be the conservationist that you are?
That's actually a darn good question, because my parents weren't really outdoors people. I mean, you know, outdoor gardening and that kind of stuff, but not really nature people. But all of my early memories revolve around nature, so I'm not 100% sure how that happened. But once I started developing this love for nature, then my parents definitely nurtured that and would take me all sorts of places and sit very patiently as I would ooh and ah and look through binoculars at bald eagles and things along those lines. But no, it's just a passion that has been in me for a very long time. And then what kind of inevitably happens is you start to fall in love with organisms, regardless of what kind of organism they are. It doesn't take long until you start seeing the problems that are facing those organisms. And so a love of nature kind of inevitably feeds into a concern for conservation issues. And so, it doesn't take long until your whole life just becomes wrapped up in this love of nature and you know, the recognition of the need for conservation. And so it doesn't take too long until your passion simply, it's not a job. I mean, it simply is what you do with your whole life. So I'm not a college professor as a job. I mean, it truly is just who I am.
It sounds like a very familiar story to me. And bats are such an interesting case because some people absolutely love them and some people absolutely do not love them. And so why don't you just start telling us a little bit about what makes bats special? And I am willing to guess that most folks don't know how many species of bats we actually have here in Iowa.
That's true. Yeah. And it is kind of interesting. I worked at a nature center during my undergraduate education. And fairly quickly as I worked at this place, I started offering bat programs. And you know, we would go out eventually after a couple of years of doing these, we'd start going out and catching them. And I did notice that there tends to be this, even among people who fear bats, there's also this element of interest. It's kind of the same thing with snakes and spiders. Yes, I'm afraid of them, but there's also kind of this cool factor to them also. So I was always excited by how many people would come out on one of these outings, and within a couple of hours, their viewpoints had really changed, and you could see that. The average bat is a very small critter. Of the nine species that regularly occur here in Iowa, the biggest one weighs in at about 2 car keys or so in weight. So they're small animals. Even if we look around the world, the biggest bats on Earth still only weigh about 2 pounds. So that's, you know, about the weight of the fox squirrels that are running around in your yards. So they're not big animals, but yet they have, you know, all of the complexity and all of the internal organs that we do just crammed into this little tiny space. There's some of the bats that we catch here in Iowa that weigh in at like about the weight of a nickel. So they are incredibly small animals. They have very long lifespans, which is quite surprising. Generally, small animals, the smaller you are, the shorter your lifespan. But quite a few bats live into their 20s and occasionally into their 30s. So that's kind of just an interesting little quirk about them. To look at their overall design, the design of their wings is so beautiful. And with birds, I'm also a bird lover, so don't get me wrong, I'm not bashing birds here. But with birds, you can't really see what's going on in their wings because they've got feathers that are covering everything up. But in bats, you know, the whole thing is perfectly visible. You've got this thin kind of translucent sheet of skin that covers their wings, so you can very perfectly see how their wings are designed. And so the design of those is just really neat to look at and neat to feel. I've had little kids say that when you feel the flight membrane of a bat, it feels kind of like bubble gum when you've blown a bubble. It's that kind of a feeling.
I was just going to ask you how you might describe that, because it's one of my best memories whenever we would need to handle the bats, is just really feeling how soft and warm that wing material is.
Yeah, no, I think that somewhere, to me, it's somewhere between like a rubber glove feeling, but you're right. It's definitely more warm and definitely more alive than a rubber glove. But it is kind of that consistency. They will get holes poked in there, and it's very common when we catch them to find, you know, small, like probably thorns or maybe an interaction with another bat where they got bits. You'll definitely see holes, but they'll seal those up pretty quickly. if we look around the world, there's about 1,200 different kinds of bats. So it's one of the biggest groups of mammals. Between rodents and bats, that's about 75% of all mammals. So they're both enormous groups. Iowa, again, has nine species, and we're much less diverse than areas to our south. So all nine of our local species are all insect eaters. But as you head down into the tropics, you start seeing a phenomenal diversity and lots of different feeding styles and feeding methods and different kinds of foods that they eat. And so I think the diversity just always stuns me.
So let's talk more about the ecological services or benefits of bats, especially in Iowa. What kind of bugs do they eat? And why should people appreciate them?
Yeah, well, that's really important. I hear lots and lots of folks talking about, I love to have bats around because they eat so many mosquitoes. And that's partially true and partially not so true. Of our nine kinds here in Iowa, there's really only one or two of them that do eat a lot of mosquitoes. Now, they do eat a lot of mosquitoes, so they're certainly doing a lot of good in that perspective. But many of them are moth eaters. There's one of the ones that we think probably is the most economically valuable is actually the same one that people usually encounter in their houses. Most folks in houses have this guy called the big brown bat. It's not a very inventive name, but that's its name. And they're also not very big, so don't expect it's something huge. But big brown bats are mostly beetle eaters. And so the estimate is that, you know, they alone are probably worth $1 billion a year or so, because a number of the insects that they eat are important pests of corn. Between the disease-causing insects that they're controlling and then the crop pest insects that they're controlling, we think that worldwide, all bats combined, just from the standpoint of eating bats, is certainly a multi-billion-dollar impact on humans. And that's only part of the impact. When you get into the tropics, you start seeing lots of bats that are vitally important in pollinating plants. Some guesses that in tropical regions, you know, we're probably dealing with 10, 20, maybe 25% of all plants are being pollinated by bats, including lots of commercially important ones. There's lots of bats that are very important in dispersing seeds. Quite a bit of the regeneration of forests in Africa is actually driven by the first wave of trees that move into these recently cleared areas are mostly being carried. Their seeds are mostly being carried there by bats. So just a hugely important group of organisms, even though most of what they're doing is at night, and so therefore we can't really see it.
Although I've seen some amazing YouTube footage of bats in the nighttime pollinating some night-blooming flowers, and just when you see the way that they fly and they come to the flower, it is just breathtaking.
Yeah, no, I won't argue with that. They have a lot of the same beauty that birds do in terms of how they appear when they fly. Interestingly, birds have really completely modified their skeletal design and their muscular design to handle flight, and bats have really just kind of tinkered with their design a bit. They really haven't gone quite as extreme as birds have, but still very effective. And I always enjoy them, just watching them fly up against the night sky and their maneuver. Ability. They're not necessarily the fastest flyers, but their ability to turn on a dime in midair just always amazes me.
So tell us a little bit more about some of the special adaptations of bats. And most people think bats are blind. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, there probably is one or two species on Earth who are blind, but other than that, the other 1,198 actually have pretty decent vision. It's actually very hard to know exactly what an animal is seeing, but we can get a basic guess of that by looking at the microscopic structure of the retina, the layer in the back of the eye. And so based on how that is built, the thought is that bats probably have about as good of night vision as we do, but they probably don't have the ability to distinguish colors as well as we do, but probably good acuity in terms of what they can see at night. And then, of course, that's added to by this unbelievable thing that we're learning more and more about, this thing that we call echolocation. And so we can talk, you know, probably for 3-4 hours about echolocation. But, you know, the gist of it is they make a high-pitched sound. The sound travels forward. It bounces off an object. And then they're able to pick up quite a bit of detail from the echoes that they get back. And again, it's a little bit complicated to understand, but each chirp that they're making during echolocation actually includes, it's usually there are three harmonics being produced at the same time. So three separate pitches, or three separate sounds at different pitches being produced at the same time. And each one of those starts at a high pitch and then swings down to a low pitch. And so essentially they're projecting out this broad bandwidth of sound, and then how or whether or not an object sends back an echo depends on how big that object is and then in relation to what sound frequency is hitting it. So in other words, a really large object will only send back low-pitched echoes. A really small object will only send back high-pitched echoes. So the bat then hears, here's the sound that I projected out, and now here is the echo that comes back to me, and they're able to then form an image based on which frequencies of sound are present in the echo and which frequencies of sound are absent in the echo. That gives them a sense for sizes and textures. And just to give you a little bit of a sense, we think that they can detect objects about the size of a human hair, and we also think that, in general, bats are probably identifying the insects that they're following. Probably not precisely, but at least down to maybe like the family level. So they're able to say, okay, this is, you know, for instance, this particular family of flies that I'm chasing right now. And this is not super well known, but the preliminary hints actually suggest that they're using the shape of the insect's wings and the frequency of the insect's wing beats to give them a sense for what kind of an insect they're chasing. So that gives you a little bit of a sense for the kind of acuity they're able to pick up with echolocation.
I definitely do not work that hard for my food. It is an amazing, astonishing story about how they get by. And I'm sure that we've all heard the term insect apocalypse lately and all of the declining insect populations. Do we have any hints that is affecting the bat populations?
Well, there's certainly, we know that many things are affecting bat populations. If you look around the world and at all of our 1,200 species, there's a greater percentage of bats that are declining in numbers than almost any other mammal group. So they are being hammered by lots of things. But as a rule, we know so little about each individual bat species that very commonly we really don't know what's causing the decline of individual species. So we know that habitat loss is a major problem for them. We know that pesticide poisoning is also extremely important for them. It does what we call biomagnifies. Pesticides tend to become more and more concentrated as you go up the food chain. And so bats at kind of a middle to upper level of the food chain are actually eating some fairly concentrated doses of pesticides. So we know that's important. In many parts of the world, bats are persecuted for a wide variety of reasons. So we know that's important. In many other organisms, we know that climate change is having giant impacts, pushing bats into new parts of the world, forcing them essentially to relocate. There's also concerns about what we're calling mismatches in prey, that basically the insect population is responding in one way to climate change, and the bats are responding in another way, and that's now creating kind of these gaps so that the insects are no longer available at the time that the bats are expecting them to be available. So a whole bunch of different factors leading to problems. And then, of course, we have what's going on right here in the Midwest right now, invasive species. So, you know, we humans are moving species around the earth at an incredible pace. So at some point within the last 15 years or so, we accidentally brought a fungus from Europe into the United States. That fungus was probably moved by people exploring caves. The fungus lives in caves, and so when the bats go into the caves to hibernate, they get infected by the fungus. And basically this fungus, which it ends up causing the disease that we call white nose syndrome, wakes the bats up periodically during hibernation. And so it just irritates them and wakes them up, and they basically burn through their fuel too fast and end up dying before hibernation is over because they've burned through so much fuel. So that's a major, major issue going on right here in the Midwest now. We're seeing big declines in surrounding states. I haven't really seen lots of indications of declines here in Iowa yet, but I'm kind of fearful that that's coming around the corner.
Overall, how are the populations of bats doing in Iowa? And would white nose syndrome be the biggest threat, you think?
How are bats doing in Iowa is actually super poorly known. If you ever hear me give a longer talk on bats, you'll unfortunately hear that phrase about 1,000 times. We don't really know what the historic populations of bats were, and so therefore we really don't have much to compare against. We know that some species clearly are declining because we can survey them, especially some of the ones that hibernate in caves. You know, people have been going into caves for a very long time and recording numbers of bats, so we have good senses for the declines in those. And a couple of those, the northern long-eared bat and the Indiana bat and the little brown bat, we know that those are declining in numbers. And that is driven, at least recently driven, by white nose syndrome. But many of those were declining already for other reasons, and we don't entirely understand those other reasons. But certainly a couple of them are declining for that. For other species, there are other concerns. So eastern red bats and hoary bats probably are declining. Again, we don't have great data, but especially just based on what I see when I'm out catching bats, eastern red bats are getting more and more fewer and far between, I guess is the way of saying that. And they get hammered by the wind turbines. And we don't entirely know why bats are colliding with wind turbines, but they do. And so we think that for eastern red bats, silver-haired bats, and hoary bats, that's probably the biggest risk facing them. And there's some computer modeling projecting that, you know, unless we change how the wind turbines are behaving, we may end up losing a species or two of bat from that. So those are significant concerns. There's also some research showing some possible ways around that, some pretty slight modifications that can be made to how the wind turbines are turned on and off that can dramatically reduce mortality. So I think there's a way around this. We just have to do some more research to figure it out.
Okay, so the average person may be terrified of bats and bats in their house. Could you maybe talk us through, you know, what do you do when there's a bat in your house? How is it really a bad situation at all? What should you do? Should you be concerned at all?
Okay, so first of all, it's important to know that when bats are in the living quarters of your house, they've made a mistake. They don't want to be there. Very commonly, bats are roosting either in the summer or in the winter, and quite often both, within the walls of your house. These are bats that previously roosted mostly in caves or in hollow trees, and so they're just looking for little cavities. And so essentially, our homes have lots of those cavities. So even though we didn't intend to do this, we created basically a mimic of the kinds of places that they were roosting in anyways. And so big brown bats especially are very common in houses. And then basically they'll make a mistake. You know, they're crawling through the wall and they come to a 2x4 and they're supposed to go right because that takes them outside. But instead they go left and now they're inside your house. So they've made a mistake. It's also important to realize that a bat in your house, bats starve to death within about 48 hours, maybe 72 hours with no food. So they're not going to live long if they're stuck in your house. The bats definitely panic when they're in your house, and you can see that. You know, they're just not really behaving in kind of a logical way. You'll open up a door, but yet they continue to fly way up high and won't come down to the level of the door. So what I recommend for people is basically just, if you have a bat in the house, there's two strategies. Basically, get a blanket, just kind of throw it up and around the bat, carry the blanket outside, open it up, and then just leave it lay there for an hour and the bat will be gone. That's strategy one. Strategy two is turn off the lights, leave, go to your local ice cream joint and have a milkshake, leave the windows and the house and the doors of your house mostly open. By the time you come back, the bat will have calmed down a bit and left. In terms of how much of a risk there actually is, it's very small. It's not zero, and so it's important to understand there is a slight risk. But once you understand more about that risk, you realize that, oh, okay, I don't need to panic about this. The big risk is rabies. And the more we learn about rabies, which there's kind of been an explosion in research there here in the last 10 years or so, but the more we learn, the more we're realizing it's pretty rare in bats. Probably 1 out of 1,000 bats at any given time will have rabies. Generally, the bats will get weak, and they'll fall to the ground, and within usually 5 to 10 days or so, they're dead. During that time when they're weak and laying on the ground, there is, however, a risk of exposure to you. And so you have to be aware of that. If you get bit by a bat, the bat either has to be tested or you have to get the rabies shots. There's just kind of no real choice. Even though the likelihood of that bat having rabies is really slim, rabies is almost always fatal, so you don't mess around with it. So if you get bit, get tested, get the bat tested, or start the shots. The shots are, I've been through them several times, they're just regular shots. In the old days, they were really painful, but they're not like that anymore. They're just regular shots. You have about 14 days from the time you're bitten until the time you start the shots. And so you've got time, so there really is no reason to panic. And so that's really the main issue that folks need to be aware of is the slight risk from rabies. But other than that, just kind of relax, realize that the bat's not intending to be there, and just use one of those two strategies to get it out of the house.
I grew up in a Victorian house that was over 100 years old, and we had bats in our house a couple times a year, so that all sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
We've just got about 2 minutes left. Can you give us a few tips on what people who care about bats or who have a greater appreciation for them now that they've heard you speak, what can we do to help make sure bats continue to thrive?
Okay, so as is always the case in nature, the number one thing you can do to help any kind of critter is learn more. Because I'll be honest, I'm 100% manipulating people. The more you learn, the more you're going to become fascinated, the more in love you're going to fall, and the more you're going to want to take action to help them. There are things that we can do to help bats. We can really push our local legislatures in terms of trying to protect local habitats. We can work on trying to get folks to do something about climate change. We know that's a looming disaster that's going to impact bats and every other organism on Earth. Bat houses are only moderately successful. They're certainly useful if you like to do woodwork, put one up. But really try and do what you can to support the protection of big blocks of local forests, especially older forests with lots of standing dead trees. That really seems to be some of the real keys for our local bat populations. We need to mess around a bit with figuring out how to modify wind turbines. So we need to keep putting pressure on lawmakers that, yes, wind turbines are a wonderful thing and the renewable energy is fantastic, but we've got to do something in terms of figuring out what to do to minimize their impact on bats.
Thank you so much, Russ, for being here with us today. We cannot wait to welcome you to Blank Park Zoo in April for Hope for the Wild. And it is called Blooms, Butterflies, and Bats. And you can get tickets today at blankparkzoo.com. Thanks again, Russ, for joining us.
You're very welcome, and I'm looking forward to my talk there.
And thank you for listening to us today. And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to blankparkzoo.com. Well, that's all the time we have for today, so join us next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.